Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the third hour, we talked about Yom Kippur, which was celebrated by Jews worldwide on Saturday. Pastor Eddie Balfour will join us here in just a moment. Tomorrow on the program, Revelation 20. You know, I've got a note on my desk to call Brian Wolfmiller out there in Aurora, Colorado. He called me last week, left a message, wanted to talk to me, wanted to my thoughts on something, and I've just been neglecting that note for a long time.
Actually, I think he called you about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Was it really 2 or 3 weeks ago?
Yes.
All right, so time has passed quicker than I thought it was. But in any event, I will be talking with him tomorrow on the air. Can we talk about what he called? What did he call me about?
Oh, he's going to be on Reformation Day. A host who belongs to a Calvary Chapel congregation is going to interview him on the Reformation. And he wanted some insights from you on that.
Oh, so he's going to go do a radio interview. Yeah. He knows how to do radio interviews. We've talked to him many times.
Well, I know, but he's got you interviewing him rather than, you know, somebody who might be a little more hostile.
He'll be fine.
Well, I'm sure he'll be fine, but you know,
you know what I should do? Tomorrow I should be hostile. Set him up for it. Right. Hey, by the way, I'm getting a busy signal in my magical hearing device that I wear on my head. We might have lost Eddie. I'm hearing a busy signal, which usually means the caller's dropped.
But you know what? I'm thankful that our guests return their messages quicker than you do, or we've had nobody on this show.
I don't answer email. I don't return messages. I didn't answer my cell phone when you called me this afternoon, did I?
No, you didn't.
Chuck will tell you I just stood there talking to him, letting it ring.
Yeah, well, I've got to call Ed now.
Okay. All right. Good. Do your job. Yeah, there we go. Crack the whip. Tomorrow on the program, Revelation 20, Pastor Brian Wolfmiller of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado, will be our guest. We'll be talking to him about that difficult passage, sometimes difficult to understand. Well, Pastor Eddie Balfour is pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. He's a convert to Christianity from Orthodox Judaism. He joins us to talk about Yom Kippur. Pastor Balfour, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you. Happy 5767.
Is that the year?
I think so. What year are you celebrating?
I'm 2006.
2006, a little behind the times.
Well, yeah, but
I
count my years from a rather insignificant date in history, just the birth of
another Jew. I know.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Before we talk about Yom Kippur, here's a short AP story on preparations that were taking place Friday for Saturday's celebration of Yom Kippur. Let's listen.
Jews in Israel are preparing for the holiest day in the Jewish calendar, Yom Kippur. The holiday starts at sundown Sunday and ends at nightfall Monday. Yom Kippur means Day of Atonement. It's traditionally a time when Jews repent for sins they've committed in the past year. They spend one full day fasting and praying. Orthodox Jews gather and pray at the western wall of Temple Mount. It's sacred to Judaism. Some bind their arms and head with special leather straps where chapters of the Torah written on parchment are kept. They also perform an ancient custom where they pass live chickens over their heads while reciting a special prayer. Jews set up stations in their neighborhoods where people can stop by and take part in the tradition. The custom symbolizes their remorse. The sins of the person are passed along to the chicken. The animal is then slaughtered and given to the poor. Larry Brown, The Associated Press.
All right, there's the story, Ed. I got to ask before we get into the heart of the origins and practice of Yom Kippur and its fulfillment in Christ. When you were an Orthodox Jew, did you ever pass a live chicken over your head?
No, I have never heard of that custom before, but it sounds like a lot of fun.
It looked like a lot of fun. The chickens seemed to be enjoying it until they got slaughtered.
Then they're kosher chickens. They held them upside down and slashed their necks, I hope.
They didn't show that part on the AP video, so...
I used to watch a guy doing that when I was a child, actually. It was where he had it's called the Shoichet. It's a special man who kills chickens and says a prayer and kosher and kosher style. And as children, we used to sneak behind his house and watch him do it. So, but we never swung him over our heads, but I would have liked to.
Now, what did you celebrate in your days of Orthodox Judaism on the day of Yom Kippur? What were you celebrating?
Well, we believed that once a year that God opened the Book of Life, and either he wrote your name in the Book of Life or he didn't for that year. And basically, Yom Kippur, being the holiest Sabbath of the year, It was a time, actually, to ask God for forgiveness for the sins that you had against him. The only way that you could ask God for forgiveness for sins against your neighbor, anyone else, was you had to first go to your neighbor and ask for forgiveness. So it was, you know, it's a Sabbath, number one. It's a holy Sabbath that is holier than all the other Sabbaths, because all holy days are Sabbaths. And it is the one time a year. Of course, I have a good friend here who's Jewish, and he says, you know, you folks are so lucky because you can ask God for forgiveness all year long. We get one shot at it, and that's very true.
Is that how you looked at it?
Exactly how I looked at it.
Now, was there any way of knowing whether God would write your name in the Book of Life on Yom Kippur as opposed to leave your name off the book for that year? Was there any way of knowing?
Well, I mean, I think you always had a doubt. You know, you always had doubts as to your own sincerity, you know, if your apology was good enough. You know, you know where this comes from, the Day of Atonement comes from. Leviticus 23 starts at 26. It says, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, on exactly the 10th day of the 7th month is the Day of Atonement, that's Yom Kippur. It shall be a holy convocation for you, and you shall humble your souls and present an offering by fire to the Lord. You shall not work on the same day, for it is the Day of Atonement, to make atonement on your behalf before the Lord. If there is any person who will not humble himself on this same day, he shall be cut off from his people. And so it says it's not to be, it is to be a Sabbath of complete rest for you, and you shall humble your souls on the 9th of the month at evening. From evening until evening you shall keep the Sabbath. So, you know, a Jewish day starts at sundown. That's why the gentleman says started on sundown Sunday and goes to sundown the next day. And any male over the age of 13 is expected to have a complete fast. Actually, it's 25 hours, an hour before sundown until sundown the following evening. So it is a day of heavy-duty meditation, heavy-duty thoughts about... And you believe that in the 10 days from Rosh Hashanah, from New Year's, until Yom Kippur, that's the time of repentance that you have to go to your neighbor. So you start thinking about all the things you've done during the year, And you've got a hustle going on because you really do want to get to the folks that you've, quote, sinned against.
Did you look forward to it, or did you dread it?
As a child, I really looked forward to it because my grandfather and I, we'd go to the synagogue literally at sun up. And we went the night before to a service called Kol Nidre, which is a service of preparation where you not only ask God to prepare you, but you ask him to release you from kind of, you know, for instance, you make an oath that says, if I get well from my illness, then I'll be in synagogue every Sabbath. Those are sins against God, oaths that you took against God that you were looking for reward. So you asked God to set you up, so to speak, so that when you went to synagogue the next day, you would truly ask for forgiveness. The problem is you never know if you're really doing that or not. Plus, there are people that you really don't want to ask sincerely. You know, you don't want to ask for their forgiveness. That's not something you want to do. And so when you do call them, sometimes as there was in my family, I always remember, I always tell this story, my mother would call one of her cousins that she really didn't like, and every year she'd say, I wish you all the happiness in the new year that you wish me. They hated each other. So, I mean, you know, that went on a lot. And did I look forward to it? Of course, I really did look forward to it because I felt so much older, I think, than I was. Going with my grandfather, who was the gabbai, which would be like head elder, head deacon in our church, and he'd lead part of the service, and I'd get to sit up front. And, yeah, I really, and it was a big deal if I could stick it out, the longer I could stick it out during the day, because you stay till sundown of that day.
So you made reference to the origins of this in the Old Testament.
Right.
Having become a Christian, how do you view those passages and what Yom Kippur was intended to be differently?
Well, you know, I look at those passages and I see, you know, certainly God gives his people here an opportunity to ask for forgiveness. I think many times as a pastor, I have people coming to me and saying, you know, I don't know whether God will, this sin is so bad, I don't know whether God will forgive me or not. And I look at these passages, and all it asks us to do is humble ourselves before the Lord. And that's how we stay in communion with our people. We're not going to be cut off. It says, you know, it shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations in your dwelling places. And I look at that like Passover, you know, where Passover was certainly the angel of death passing over the Israelites as they did what God told them. And you carry that over to, it says, the feast shall be from generation to generation. We keep that at the, you know, in the sacrament of the altar. And it seems to me this is just a natural progression from where the Jews were. And once the Messiah comes, it's not only offered on this day, but it's offered over and over again, because now we have a priest also who doesn't have to cleanse himself. And so here you're dealing with the high priest, and now we got the high priest, and I think that's the real difference. But a real natural progression, just like Passover. Christ is our Passover, has been sacrificed for us. So, you know, so we keep the feast. And I think here again, nothing much has changed except God's, you know, God was always available, but now God's people are able to see how available he truly is. And when I hear my Jewish friend say exactly that, you people can ask for forgiveness all the time, and it's always granted. But I have to wait another year if I don't get this done, he says. And he thinks about how good he's been to his wife. He's thinking about good deeds, how good he's been to his friends, you know, how good he's been. That's all I heard over and over again when I went to coffee the week leading up to Yom Kippur, and he was quite distressed. He's a pretty good guy, but he was very distressed about himself and if he could pull this off before Yom Kippur.
So he was taking this very seriously.
Well, what Jews do. I always said, people ask me, you know, do you know the day of your conversion? You know, I always laugh because I believe God worked very slowly in my heart until I was believing things I was resisting. But I think the real day, the test for me, was the first time that I did not go to synagogue on Yom Kippur. Because, you know, I was waiting for the heavens to open up and God to come down and get me. This was a real test for me, because Jews who don't go to synagogue all year long, even if they miss Rosh Hashanah, most of them don't, the most unreligious Jew will show up on Yom Kippur. He'll close his business. He's not going to work on Yom Kippur. There's a threat. There's a real fear about Yom Kippur. And, I still know when it is, because it's still, to me, as I, with my Jewish friends, it gives me an opportunity to witness to them. And I saw this man, as I said, I saw this man just extremely distressed before this day. And I don't believe he's done anything quite to be that distressed about. Certainly he's a sinner, but I wish he believed and had his eyes open to Christ. But the distress he was going through, you know, it's what all Jews go through on that day, especially Jews that aren't real religious. They go through it more. Because the guilt is really, you know, is horrendous.
Folks, we'll take your questions and your comments on Yom Kippur or any other issue related to the calendar of Judaism for the next 10 minutes with Pastor Ed Balfour, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can email us here in the studio as well, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
While you're waiting for calls, I just want to tell you there's five really prohibitions on Yom Kippur, and I think people don't really understand. When I say you can't eat or you can't drink, by the way, you can't have any liquid for those 25 hours. You can't even bathe or brush your teeth because water might pass your lips. So, I mean, that the laws of Yom Kippur are stringent. You can't wear any kind of cologne. Men and women are not allowed to have marital relations. You'll go into a synagogue on Yom Kippur. You'll see the men don't have shoes on. They're in their stockings because you can't wear leather. So, I mean, there's all these prohibitions that go along with it that make the holy day that much more stark, I guess I want to say.
So why didn't you mentioned the first time you didn't go to synagogue on Yom Kippur. Why didn't you go?
Well, I guess at the time, and I was working, it was very important for me to really believe that I truly was a Christian and believed, and I really, you know, nothing against visiting a synagogue, but I really had to. That was to me totally cutting the cord, knowing that I was really a Christian. Was that I felt I had gone away from everything but that, you know, the year before. But here was the day, this first year that I considered myself after baptism to be a real Christian. To me, to walk in there would have been superstition, and I had to fight the superstition of walking in there. I wasn't going to do that anymore.
Seems odd, Eddie, that the there are many Christians who go through the same kind of anxiety when it comes to the guilt for their sin. They think that's how it ought to be. You kind of take your shot with God. Yeah, you can do it every day, but you take your shot with God, you say you're sorry for what you've done, and then you spend the rest of your time wondering whether you were really sincere enough for God to forgive you. There are a lot of Christians who think that's what their confession of sin really is all about.
Well, yeah, it is, you know, it is like parishioners that come over and over to the altar with the same sin that they've already asked God for forgiveness. It really, to me, it's more of a doubt. It's more doubting God, because God says that if you're humbly sorry and repent, He forgives and forgets your sin. And so I think this is certainly this is part of sin, bringing that same sin over and over again, because we believe somehow by doing that God forgives us more. But Jews really have a lot of practice at that.
And if you were to say to your Jewish friend, look, I don't know that you would say this given the context of your conversations, but if you were to say, look, as a Christian now, I believe Yom Kippur is fulfilled. It's fulfilled in the sacrifice Christ made at the cross. That's the Day of Atonement that renders all other days of atonement obsolete. There's the atonement once and for all sins.
Well, there's no problem saying that to him. He basically has been the, I don't know if you read that article in Lutheran Witness that I wrote, but he is a gentleman who was president of the local Orthodox synagogue here. The synagogue I actually spoke about my journey into Christianity. He's very open to study. We've been studying a lot together, and certainly we speak in those terms. He comes to church with his wife every Sunday. He comes to my Bible study, so he's very interested. I think the Holy Spirit is truly working in his heart.
Let's talk with Jeff, who's listening in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. Jeff, thanks for your patience. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure speaking to both of you. I've been involved in Messianic Jewish ministry for a long time, and I was just kind of curious from a Lutheran perspective. I know there's a lot who, since the New Year, I guess in biblical times, began more around Passover.
Right.
Right? And
yeah.
A lot of people see a typological significance with Passover, then First Fruits, and then Rosh Hashanah, then Yom Kippur, then the Feast of Tabernacles. And I was wondering, from a Lutheran perspective, if there's in just kind of the order of it, too, I was wondering from a Lutheran perspective if that's common with you guys.
Jeff, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening out there in Pennsylvania. What about the Old Testament calendar of feasts and its pointing forward to Christ? Do you see a significance there in the order?
I would agree with part in saying that I think the pointing to Christ, certainly the highlight of it there, has to be the Passover feast, you know, and the sacrifice of the lamb. I think that certainly is the highlight and the pointer that we have there. But I'm not really, again, I'm not an expert on the typological order of this, and here would only be my own opinion. And certainly Passover to me is really the highlight of where it points to Christ. I really am not an expert on the rest of that.
Well, and I just say this, Jeff, the general rule of thumb I use when it comes to trying to find types of Christ in the Old Testament, it's fine to speculate on this feast or that feast or this entity or that entity. Always safest to go with those types, to say for certain those types of Christ that are ratified, if you will, by the New Testament. The New Testament tells us this is a type of Christ. There you got, you're on solid ground with things like the Passover. There's no doubt when Paul says Christ our Passover has now been sacrificed, he's drawing a definite picture to the Old Testament Passover and giving us a type that we can hang our hat on. Otherwise, doing a little bit of guesswork there.
Yeah, and again, that's why, you know, in our own church here, on Monday, Thursday, you know, I hesitate to call it a Passover feast, but certainly we do, you know, we have a prelude to our service, to our last communion before Easter Sunday. That is very much in the tradition of the Passover Supper, because we believe it's kind of a natural progression from looking from, again, the angel of death passing over the doors of the Jews where the blood was spread from lintel to lintel, and we look at the cross and we see that same blood spread over that cross, the angel of death once again passing over, the blood of Christ dripping down into the cup of salvation that we drink. And so we see that significance. We highlight it in our church here, but I really don't do that with any of the other holy days, because I don't really have that connection to it. So
finally, then, to the Jewish person listening to us now, who's just come off the celebration of Yom Kippur, they spent their time in the synagogue, and they may be experiencing the same kind of doubt as to whether or not they were sincere enough. What would you say to them in the final minutes here, with only about a minute here, Eddie?
Well, you know, it was very difficult for me when I was practicing Judaism to believe I was forgiven. I guess the only thing I can say to them that you know, we know that Christ truly forgives our sins, truly cleanses us from all unrighteousness, and it's only by faith that you truly believe that. I fought it over and over again. It's very difficult for me to make excuses for Jews and tell them, well, you know, God truly forgives you. Without pointing to Christ and the true forgiveness in his body and blood, it's very difficult to give folks on that end of it hope, except to say that God can work in your heart even as you oppose that working, that he can point you to the cross. I can verify that as fact.
Pastor Ed Balfour is a convert to Christianity from Orthodox Judaism. He's pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Pastor, thanks for being our guest.
Blessings to you, Jeff. God be with you.
Thank you. Well, when we come back from this break, it's audio open lines for your questions and your comments. What we're going to do, in Massachusetts, they've had gay marriage now for a couple of years, full-blown legalized gay marriage. Their neighbors in Rhode Island have not. Now, the law there is ambiguous. It doesn't forbid it, and it doesn't permit it. And a judge has decided that that means that those who reside in Rhode Island, if they wish, can go to Massachusetts with their same-sex partners, whoever that may be, receive legal gay marriage in Massachusetts, bring it back, and it's good, and it's golden in Rhode Island. We'll hear the story on that from National Public Radio when we come back from this break, and we'll have audio open lines, your reaction to it. And as time permits, Senator Jack Danforth was on Meet the Press with Tim Russert recently. We'll play the interview from that program also during audio open lines. Our call-in numbers for audio open lines in the last half hour, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We have an in-studio email address. It's issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. And we might even be able to get to a couple other things that we've just been holding in reserve, a little bit of audio we've been holding in reserve in the next half hour of the program. Stay tuned and get ready to call 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
How do we teach our children about the nature of the true God? One God, three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Our Creator, our Redeemer, our Sanctifier. From the very earliest years of the Christian Church, Christian parents have taught their children about God using the Apostles' Creed. This ancient and simple creed is a confession of faith in the one true God. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for October is a children's picture book called The Apostles' Creed. For more information about this children's book, go to our website, issuesetc.org. The Apostles' Creed is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for October, The Apostles' Creed.
Uluru, It's a testimony to Noah's blood.
Answers with Ken Ham, a popular speaker and author from Australia. Ken, I've never heard of Uluru until recently. What in the world is it?
Well, Mark, you probably have heard of it as Ayers Rock in Australia. It's the biggest rock in the world, and its Aboriginal name happens to be Uluru. Now, this enormous rock rises over 1,000 feet above the desert sands, and it really is a great testimony to the flood of Noah's day. You see, the evidence indicates that this 4-mile-thick sandstone layer, which makes up this rock, had to be deposited quickly. Evolutionists, though, insist that this formation formed slowly over millions of years. But the sandstone making up this rock, it's called arkose, is composed of grains that are of many different sizes, and they're very jagged. This indicates the grains were deposited quickly. You see, if the grains had been transported slowly over millions of years, they'd be rounded and sorted, the opposite of what scientists find. Also, the feldspars in the rock are fresh and shiny. If the rock was millions of years old, they'd have turned into clay. There's so much evidence such as this from all around the world that fits with the explanation from Genesis about Noah's flood. That's why creation geologists believe Uluru was formed quickly, which is what we'd expect based on Genesis.
If you've ever doubted the Bible's account of a global flood and Noah's Ark, you need to read Ken Ham's free booklet. It's available on our website, AnswersRadio.com. Look for the free Noah's Flood booklet when you go to AnswersRadio.com.
President Dean Wenthy on the future of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
In every way, I can't believe the blessings that we have been given, as we Lutherans say, not with any merit or worthiness on our part, but by God's grace, he continues to lead talented, dedicated men and women to give their lives to him and to the truth of the gospel. And I'd like to invite any of your listeners to come and visit us, but more than visit, worship with us, be my guest for a campus tour, and see how our life revolves around this wonderful truth that the incarnate Christ has brought to our world.
To accept Dr. Wenthy's invitation for an on-campus tour at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, call 1-800-481-2155. Dining with Sinners. That's what happens every Sunday at Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. The Lord Jesus himself comes and spreads his banquet table before us, sinners, not a target group of professionals, but sinners in need of the one thing that only he can give, the forgiveness that he won for us at the cross. Christian, seeker, unbeliever, it doesn't matter. All those who are burdened by their sin and hungry for God's forgiveness are invited to visit Bethany Lutheran Church, 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. Welcome back for the last half hour of Issues Etc. It's Audio Open Lines. Before we get to that audio, you know, I think it's every single week we've got an update story on Darfur. It sits there in our audio bank, ready to go, and we usually have other things that we get to before that. But every single week there's an update on Darfur that we have ready to play for you. I'm not going to guarantee we'll play one for you now, but do not forget about it, just because it's very easy when that segment in the news comes on to say, okay, bad news from Darfur, and turn it down and talk to your wife. Do not forget what's going on there or the victims of displacement, civil war in the Sudan. LCMS World Relief has not forgotten. LCMS World Relief is doing everything they can, and the going is getting tough for relief agencies in the Sudan of late, but they're sticking to it. They're bringing that touch of mercy and a concern for both body and soul to the victims of those man-made disasters in Africa. For more information about LCMS World Relief, go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or you can call them and donate toll-free, 1-888-930-4438. 1-888-930-4438. It's Audio Open Lines. We want your response to the latest that's come out of Massachusetts, just when you think they've got legal gay marriage for the last several years. They seem to have resolved that problem, or at least what they considered to be a problem. I've always been asking this question from the very time Massachusetts legalized gay marriage. You know, we have that full faith and credit clause in the U.S. Constitution. Will their marriages be valid elsewhere? and vice versa. Well, here's a story from National Public Radio on the latest in a Massachusetts court regarding that very question.
A Massachusetts court ruled today that gay and lesbian couples from Rhode Island can marry in Massachusetts. It's the first time couples who live out of state will be allowed to take advantage of gay marriage in Massachusetts. NPR's Tobia Smith reports.
Shortly after Massachusetts' highest court opened the door for gay marriage here, Governor Mitt Romney said he didn't want Massachusetts to become the Las Vegas of gay marriage, and he started enforcing a century-old law that would block out-of-staters from marrying here if they couldn't marry back home. But a court today gave the okay to a couple from Rhode Island, saying that even though gay marriage isn't explicitly legal there, it's not expressly outlawed either. So the court now says 2 years after they first tried, Rhode Island residents Wendy Becker and Mary Norton can marry in Massachusetts.
Oh, we are so thrilled. Mary called and I picked up the phone and she yelled, "We won," and it was just absolutely thrilling. And I started crying and screaming and my colleagues came running in my office and we had an impromptu party.
With her 6-year-old daughter ecstatic that she can finally buy her flower girl dress, Becker immediately started making wedding plans. And she says she and her partner are not the only ones in Rhode Island doing so.
We know of people who are waiting for this decision and want to get married. So we are certainly hoping that more people will take advantage of this and expect that they will.
There are just a few other states, including New Jersey and New Mexico, where the law so far is silent enough on gay marriage that residents might also be allowed to marry in Massachusetts. Opponents of gay marriage say today's decision will only fuel efforts in those states and elsewhere for constitutional bans on gay marriage. And even in Rhode Island, this may be just the beginning of a long battle. Rhode Island's governor opposes gay marriage, and the state's attorney general says Massachusetts' ruling does not mean that Rhode Island will recognize a same-sex marriage for Massachusetts. He says only the Rhode Island legislature or courts can decide that issue. So as soon as a same-sex couple, like Becker and Norton, tries to file a joint tax return or applies for work benefits, litigation may be inevitable. Conservative activists like Matt Staver of the Liberty Council say they're also looking into ways to challenge today's decision on its face.
I think for a Massachusetts court to assume that another state permits same-sex marriage because it doesn't expressly prohibit it, notwithstanding the fact that its traditions have never recognized same-sex marriage, is just simple grasping at air and is overreaching at best and certainly arrogant at worst.
But gay rights activists dismiss that argument. Michelle Granda, the attorney for the Rhode Island couple, says the Massachusetts court is not imposing its views on Rhode Island.
In fact, Rhode Island has made up its own mind, and in fact, Rhode Island had the opportunity to amend its laws to expressly prohibit couples from marrying. They did not. Rhode Island's already made a decision for itself that it's not a state that it wants to discriminate. So why should Massachusetts create roadblocks for Rhode Island that Rhode Island hasn't created for itself?
Massachusetts Attorney General says he will not appeal today's decision, since the state's highest court has already spoken on the matter. But Governor Mitt Romney is urging him to reconsider, saying the decision will wrongly export Massachusetts gay marriage to other states. A spokesman says the governor finds today's decision illogical. If gay couples truly are not barred from marrying in their own state, he says, then they shouldn't need to come to Massachusetts to do it. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
All right, there's the story from National Public Radio. Talk about confusion. All right, let me see if I can sort this out if it wasn't clear enough. Massachusetts has legalized gay marriage. That's been the case for a couple of years now. The question I raised when it happened was, what about the fact that under other circumstances, a marriage conducted in one state is valid in another? Under the old definition of marriage, that is one man, one woman. It falls under the full faith and credit clause of the U.S. Constitution that in these kind of matters, states honor one another's laws and peculiarities, right? So, I got married in Missouri. My wife and I moved to Illinois. We're still married. Illinois recognizes a Missouri marriage. Even though our license was written in a county in Missouri, they recognize it. Full faith and credit. Right. Okay. Here's the logic of the judge in this case. Look, New Jersey, their law is, quote, silent enough on gay marriage that I can say it's neither legal nor illegal. Therefore, if they want to come over here to Massachusetts and get married, they can. And interestingly enough, they're saying, oh, we're not imposing our legalized gay marriage on Rhode Islanders. Did you hear the spokesman, the one spokesman there near the end? She said, well, Rhode Islanders already made this decision. They had the opportunity to pass a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. They didn't, ergo, they approve of gay marriage. It still seems a little bit of a leap. So if the law doesn't expressly prohibit something, it must permit it. And Rhode Island isn't the only state. There are at least two others, New Jersey among them, who have vague laws regarding marriage, so vague that judges in Massachusetts think, wow, maybe they can come here too and get married. What do you make of this? It is confusing. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Remember, though, if you're a resident of Rhode Island, by the way, isn't Craig now going to be a resident of Rhode Island, our good old Craig Allen, who just left us last week? He's moving up to Rhode Island to start a business up there, and all God's best blessings to him. But he's going to be a resident of Rhode Island, right?
Yes.
He has no plans for taking a weekend trip to Massachusetts, I assume.
This is why they gave us a piece of equipment to make profound statements, such as yes.
Wait, he is planning a weekend trip to Massachusetts?
I was talking about the answer to the previous question.
Okay, now answer my second question. He's not moving to Rhode Island because of this law, is he? I mean, this wasn't an elaborate ruse on his part?
No.
I didn't think so. I think he still likes the ladies, doesn't he? Yeah, okay, good. Well, if you try and take your Massachusetts same-sex marriage back to Rhode Island, the governor of Rhode Island says, we may not even recognize it. He didn't say they wouldn't recognize it, but he said, we may not even recognize it. So when they get ready to file their tax return, they might have a rude awakening if they try to file as married. Filing jointly married might be tough. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's go to the phones. It's audio open lines, and you can email us to issuesetc@kfuo.org. I would really like to hear from any attorneys we have listening to us as to whether any of this holds water, or is this just another instance of a judge getting cute with the law? Lael calls from her car. Hi, Lael.
Hi, Pastor. I just had a question. What would be the repercussions when they start divorcing, too? Because, you know, that's going to be a legal thing, and I don't know how would it apply in the state they would be in. Would they have to go to Rhode Island? I mean, isn't that another big issue that they're
Actually, that's a very good question, Lael, because if your marriage is in Massachusetts,
yeah,
but not recognized in the state where you are, which is the case, a lot of people, most of the marriages that have been performed in Massachusetts since their approval of gay marriage, have been from out-of-state people who just, as a symbolic gesture, go to Massachusetts, get their marriage, go home. They know their marriage isn't valid in their home state, but if they want a divorce and they take their marriage certificate seriously,
right,
they might have to plan another visit back to Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Complicated.
Very complicated. Thank you very much, Lael. It's a good question. Sure. I don't know if there has been a... Something in the back of my mind says that there was the first gay marriage divorce in Massachusetts, but maybe I'm just imagining things. Herman is calling from Illinois. Hi, Herman.
Thank you for taking my call. Just calling on the comment of the last caller. This is a news summary from the New York Times, August 23rd of this year from Vermont. It reads, Carolyn Conrad and Kathleen Peterson, who entered into the nation's first same-sex civil union on July 1, 2000, officially split up. Conrad, 35, filed to end the union in October and later obtained a restraining order against her partner, saying Peterson had punched a hole in the wall during an argument and threatened to harm a friend. So the first venture into this type of alternative union has ended with a domestic violent overtone, as many of these lesbian situations in this instance are prone to do. So as the comment from the previous caller about breaking up, they do break up. And I think we need to see that the reality of this is they do break up, and it does involve domestic violence. And as these people try to sort of throw it in the face of the heterosexual couple, man and woman, say you're just old-fashioned and backward, they have a lot of twisted ordeals themselves that they go through.
Thank you, Herman. Herman's getting a little worked up there, too. Thank you very much for the call. Yes, no doubt about it. They do and they will break up. Now, let's be careful. And I think Herman would fully concur when I say that that alone is not a measure of the validity or the wisdom or prudence of same-sex marriage, or imprudence, I should say, of same-sex marriage, because, of course, heterosexual marriages break up all the time, too, and are subject to the same kind of domestic violence. But as a matter of fact, if we want same-sex marriage, we will also be dealing in the future with same-sex divorce. Andy calls from Kirkwood. Hi, Andy.
Well, Todd, Kinky Friedman down in Texas has said that he's in favor of same-sex marriage because they have the right to be just as miserable as the rest of us. But I did want to confirm that not only has the first gay marriage in Massachusetts ended in divorce, but the first civil union in Vermont has ended that way as well.
How do you divorce in a civil union?
I really don't know, but, it is a legal union, so you got to go to law to break it, I suppose.
All right, thank you.
Either
Andy.
That or move to a different state.
Yeah, you could. I guess you could move to a state where civil unions are not recognized and just say, poof, it's gone. I mean, I know how a divorce works. I know basically how a divorce works, because marriage is recognized legally. And in order to dissolve that relationship, I'm not talking about the personal relationship, but I'm talking about the legal relationship recognized by the state. In order to dissolve that, you got to get the state's approval. Just as you got to get the state's approval to enter into it, you have to get the state's approval to get out of it. Plus, there's property. There are all sorts of other issues involved there. Sometimes there are things like restraining orders. There are children to be, I was going to say disposed of, but that sounds terrible. They're domestic issues. And all of this goes along with same-sex unions or same-sex marriages. Well, former Missouri Senator John Danforth was interviewed by Tim Russert recently on Meet the Press. It was two Sundays ago, exactly. The two discussed Senator Danforth's new book. It's called Faith and Politics. Here's a bit of that.
You are a former United States Senator and former Ambassador to the United Nations, an ordained Episcopal priest, and you've written a book on faith and politics. And we take particular note of it this morning because of the things that you have said. Let's share that with our viewers. By a series of recent initiatives, Republicans have transformed our party into the political arm of conservative Christians. The elements of this transformation have included advocacy of a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, opposition to stem cell research involving both frozen embryos and human cells in petri dishes, and the extraordinary effort to keep Terry Schiavo hooked up to a feeding tube. Standing alone, each of these initiatives has its advocates within the Republican Party and beyond, but the distinct elements do not stand alone. Rather, they are parts of a larger package, an agenda of positions common to conservative Christians and the dominant wing of the Republican Party. You're suggesting the Christian right has taken over the Republican Party?
Yeah, I think it has. This is the base of the Republican Party, and the nature of politics in America now is to appeal to the political base to the exclusion of everybody else. And I think that's it's happened in both parties. The Democrats have their base. Our base is the Christian conservatives.
Why has this happened? And shouldn't the Christian conservatives be saluted for standing up and exercising their democratic franchise?
Well, they certainly have the right to speak out, and I would hope that everybody who speaks out from the standpoint of religion would do so with some degree of humility, recognizing that they don't have a monopoly on truth. But the problem is when a political party becomes a sectarian party, when it becomes the party of one branch of one religion.
All right, now I got to respond to one thing that the senator had to say. Former Senator John Danforth is the one being interviewed there on Meet the Press, and Tim Russert. He doesn't mind if religious people enter into politics and argue for their convictions and do it so with vigor, as long as they recognize that they haven't cornered the market on the truth. They don't have a monopoly on the truth. Now, that's an odd statement for a man to make who doesn't believe anyone hasn't cornered the market on the truth. He seems to believe he's cornered the market on at least one truth, and that is that Christians shouldn't believe they have cornered the market on the truth. That statement itself is a statement, I think he would say, of truth. A good follow-up on Russert's part, although it would completely sidetrack the interview. I don't expect Russert to ask this question, is, but Senator Danforth, do you believe that what you just said is true? Well, yes. Well, do you think you've cornered the market on truth with respect to that one issue? Is the problem that the religious right has taken over the Republican Party, as he says, or is the problem that there are claims out there in politics or in religion, I can't really tell which concerns him more, of absolute truth? Is his real issue that people are advocating for an absolute truth, an absolute right, or wrong? Or does it only worry him when it's embodied in a political party or written into legislation? This is the guy who spent, and we must commend Senator Danforth for this, under the first President Bush, was it? He was a special envoy to the Sudan, if I'm not mistaken. That was second President Bush. It was just first term. He was a special envoy. He went at the behest of President Bush to the Sudan to look things over. Of course, things have fallen apart terribly, not due to Senator Danforth's action or inaction. But he saw, he has seen firsthand evils in this world. I mean, everyone's got their evils. Everyone's got their rights and their wrongs. No matter where they draw the line. Now, he comes back. Let's just say he comes back from the Sudan and he says to President Bush, terrible situation over there. Great wrongs are being done to the citizens of the Sudan. Well, how can you make that judgment? Do you think you've cornered the market on truth? How can you say what they're doing is wrong as opposed to what we're doing over here? Come on. Do you think you've cornered the market on truth? This is the problem with that little trick that is so often played in politics and in the church. Is it works both ways, baby. His basic concern, though, he says, is that Christian conservatives have taken over the Republican Party. It strikes me as odd because I think that the influence of Christian conservatives has actually waned a little bit. That's my opinion, but I think it's actually waned a little bit in the Republican Party since President Bush has taken power. I think they were a lot more energized during the Clinton years. Really? And we didn't hear these expressions of concern about that during the Clinton years. My opinion. Back to the interview between Tim Russert and Jack Danforth.
And I think that that's what's happened to the Republican Party. And I would hope that the Republican Party would get back to its moorings.
You write with real conviction, Senator, this is what you say, when Christians claim special knowledge of God's truth, when they advance wedge issues, when they divide America between people of faith and their enemies, Christians become not the means of peace, but the cause of conflict. In that case, Christians are far from being powerless. They are powerful contributors to what has gone wrong in American politics. Very strong.
Well, I think that that's true. And to me, one of the messages of religion, in fact, the meaning of the word religion, has to do with holding people together. It's the same root as the word that ligament comes from. But I think, in fact, religion in various parts of the world, Iraq, for example, has become the means of division and bloodshed. And in our own country, when it's used politically, and we've always seen this, our founding fathers saw it when they wrote the Constitution, religion has the capacity to divide us. So if religion is presented as sort of my way is God's way and your way is not, you're against God, there can be no more divisive factor in politics than that.
Christian conservatives who step forward and say, however, Senator, I believe that abortion is the taking of a life. I believe that there is a life in that petri dish, and that's why I'm against stem cell research. I believe the Bible teaches me that homosexuality is immoral. How can you ask me to compromise on those kinds of life and death
and
moral issues?
I'd say take your position and take it strongly. I'm sure you're going to do that. But recognize also that you're not God, and that there is a difference between anybody's political position or moral position and God. and that we have to try to recognize that other people also are trying to be faithful, even though they don't agree with us. And if you have that kind of humility, it makes the art of politics possible. Whereas if it becomes, you know, I know God's will and you don't, then it seems to me that we've got a very divided country.
All right, there's the interview between Tim Russert and Senator John Danforth on Meet the Press. I don't know why Senator Danforth continues to push this wedge issue of embryonic stem cell research in Missouri. Why does he do this? I just wish he'd recognize he's not God, that he doesn't have an absolute corner on the market of truth. I wish he'd be more humble and recognize that he can't speak for God on this issue of embryonic stem cell research. He says we should do it, that Missourians should permit and I imagine eventually fund embryonic stem cell research for life-saving cures. I don't know why he continues to push that wedge issue. It's dividing us. It's dividing Missourians. I just really wish he would recognize that he's not God. You see, it works both ways. Now imagine a Southern slave owner telling a Christian abolitionist, don't tell me that you know what's right or wrong on the issue of slavery. Do you think you're God? What do you think? You've cornered the market on truth? It's a good thing that postmodernism and moral relativism wasn't alive and well to the degree it is today, 150 years ago in this country. If it were, do you know what the result would have been? We'd still own slaves. We would. Because some bright politician or former politician would stand up and say, look, come on. These Christian abolitionists, they've taken over the Republican Party. And why are they pushing this wedge issue of emancipation? I just wish they'd recognize they're not God. They need more humility. If that kind of reasoning and argumentation would have been around 150 years ago in this country, there never would have been a civil rights movement. And we'd all still own slaves. Good thing. Good thing that people weren't arguing that way 150 years ago. Well, tune in again tomorrow at 3 for Issues, etc. We're going to be talking about perhaps one of the more famous chapters of the book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 20. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller will be our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, etc. Issues, etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.